Most of the black papers in segregated Jim Crow America folded quickly. Many, not closed by offended whites, died of the poverty of their readers and potential advertisers. But a few papers, started early in the new century, survived and gained influence, including the melodramatic Chicago Defender and the more conservative Pittsburgh Courier. In 1915, the Ku Klux Klan was reborn in the guise of a fraternal lodge society. The blockbuster movie Birth of a Nation helped the Klan recruit millions of white Protestant, 100% American, men and women. White newspapers were beginning to aim for objective reporting, but that didn't free newsmen from what they'd been taught about history. Hunter Bell edited the Atlanta Journal in the 1920s.
You know, of course, the Klan was born at a time when they had to have it, otherwise the South would have never survived. The North freed all these Negroes and set them up in their legislatures, and I've read a lot about it. It must have been a good organization, but in the 20s, it had no real reason for existence.
In the 1920 election, Florida's African Americans organized to reclaim their voting rights.
The election of 1920 was the first in which women would vote. On September 16th, the Jacksonville Daily Metropolis warned, "Democracy endangered by very large registration of black women."
White voters, remember, belittle it as the Republicans may, yet it is true that white supremacy is being assaulted in our midst, and the most sacred institutions of the South are being undermined by the enemy from within. Dade County Democratic Executive Committee. Paid advertisement.
Jail for illegal voters on General Election Day. Thousands of Negro women and men who have sworn falsely in getting on the registration books are known to officials. Law violators will be promptly arrested when they present themselves at polling places on November 2nd. Jacksonville, Florida Times Union.
Historian Paul Ortiz.
There are a number of open Klan marches and demonstrations that occur on the eve of the election.
Silent hosts of Ku Klux Klan parade with impressive numbers. Jacksonville Times Union, October 30th.
Between 80 and 100 members of the Ku Klux Klan paraded in Daytona last night and told of the principles of the Klan, which was about white supremacy in the South. Daytona Daily News, November 2nd, 1920.
Orlando had a real sensation during the busy Saturday evening trade when, without warning, a large company of the Ku Klux Klan, the leaders on horseback, suddenly appeared on Orange Avenue.
The Klansmen who staged that martial patriotic pageantry and the newsmen who reported it knew it packed a punch. No one today would report the Klan this way, but that doesn't mean all journalists would be more critical and enterprising than was then Atlanta Journal editor Hunter Bell.
I was just covering it from a casual standpoint because we didn't think it was much of a story. We didn't have the investigative reporters in those days. We kind of felt that we printed what we call privileged material and we didn't fool with it. You had libel laws then were far stricter than they are now. If we'd had investigative reporters, I'd probably join and got to the nub of it and got my head beat off.
The campaign to warn scalawags and carpetbaggers and Negroes not to vote climaxed on Election Day in the small central Florida town of Ocoee.
The Negroes who were traditional Republicans were turning out en masse at the polls. Some of the poor whites who are traditional Democrats resented this under the heading that the Negroes were voting jobs away from the local people.
From an account by celebrated anthropologist and novelist Zora Neale Hurston, who lived nearby.
Mose Norman was struck and driven off. While he was away from his car, some of the disorderly whites went to the car and found a shotgun under the seat. When he returned to the car, he was set upon and driven off. Then the white mobs grew more disorderly and unmanageable.
The editor of the Tampa Tribune, a nearby mainstream, which then meant white, newspaper, described the incident somewhat differently.
The affair was precipitated by a Negro inflamed with the arrogant idea that he had a right to vote regardless of the laws of the state. He had not paid his poll tax and became threatening when refused the vote. He went home and got a gun after those threats. He came back and began to make trouble, and when called down, he reached for his gun. That, in this state, is suicide. And the fact that other members of his race attempted to carry on the trouble indicates that some mighty bad advice, or mighty bad liquor, or both, had been indulged in by the Negroes of that sect.
The Orlando Sentinel reported,
"With darkness coming on, it was reported that the angry black was at the head of a band of enraged Negroes. A posse was formed, and an effort was made to disperse the Negroes."
Toward sundown, it was suggested that they go over to Mose Norman's house and give him a good beating for his officiousness and for being a smart aleck. But someone going around the lake had seen him visiting July Perry, a very prosperous Negro farmer and contractor.
White reporters at the time didn't seem to realize at first that two different black men were involved.
What were the reporting standards of the day, and does a white reporter really report objectively on an incident of racial violence?
Historian David Colburn.
I would argue that a white reporter in this day and time is operating under standards that suggest that you better report the story as an example of a black citizen stepping across the line of what is considered appropriate. And the only way you can get an alternative point of view is to have somebody like Zora Neale Hurston or the NAACP do its own investigation, in which they talk to some of the black sources. They won't communicate with a white reporter, because then they know their names will come to the attention of the community and they might suffer retribution.
Seven or eight Negroes were traced to a house which was surrounded.
July Perry armed himself and prepared to defend himself and his home. He was effective. The mob was forced to retreat and considered what was best to do.
The Negroes opened fire, and eight shots were discharged at the white men.
Newspapers nationwide picked up the local reports. The New York Times.
Enforcements arrived and the firing became general. The Perry house ultimately was set on fire to dislodge them, the flames spreading.
At 4:45 this morning, a telephone communication said the blaze was growing in volume and more Negro houses were burned.
The Orlando Sentinel.
The operator stated the blaze was so large it appeared to be churches or schoolhouses. Notice. Ex-servicemen are requested to be at the police headquarters at 7:30 in uniform. It is declared that between 500 and 1,000 rounds of ammunition exploded in the church and in Perry's house, where the congregated and desperate blacks fought like demons. The situation is in the hands of reliable citizens, ex-servicemen and home guards, and no further trouble is anticipated. The officials are standing for law and order.
By now, the press claimed to report only objective facts. But when reporters used powerful images and words like demons and reliable citizens, it raises questions of which facts and who their papers serve.
The number killed will never be known.
Walter F. White, an investigator for the NAACP, was able to probe dozens of lynchings and massacres because his light skin enabled him to pass as a white man.
At the time that I visited, the last colored family of Ocoee was leaving with their goods piled high on a motor truck with six colored children on top. White children stood around and jeered the Negroes who were leaving, threatening them with burning if they did not hurry up and get away.
The 1920 census for the Ocoee area said there were 495 blacks. That's 495 individuals, not families. And as of 1930, there were only two.
Community activist Curtis Michelson.
Walter White would later take over the NAACP's publicity and press work. But when the group tried to bring the 1920 election disruptions before congressional hearings, they were shouted down. The black press just didn't have the clout then to get results.
It was really, at this point, really only one organ that can cohere African-American opinion and African-American urgency.
Historian Adam Green.
The Crisis is a magazine of NAACP that has an appreciable circulation by the 1920s, though it is diminishing, and it's going to reach below 10,000 by the 1930s in the Depression.
I suspect the white journalists of the South hardly knew that the Crisis, the NAACP magazine, existed.
Historian Ray Arsenault.
They may have had a sense that there was something called the Chicago Defender and the Pittsburgh Courier and maybe some of the other
black newspapers here and there. The Chicago Defender, obviously. The Messenger is a magazine that A. Philip Randolph was involved with. But there isn't the kind of coordination. There isn't the kind of trading, there isn't the kind of mutual reinforcement that exists in the 1940s. And I think there isn't also that sense of how to assemble and cohere the potential of that media, not only to influence black opinion, but to influence white opinion.
They probably had very little consciousness of the black press in the 1920s and 30s and 40s. It really wasn't on their radar screen.